I'm Dr. Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, with another of my screenside chats for our ACAP members. For those of you who are listening for the first time, screenside chats are meant to share timely clinical practice and other information from experts on key topics, mostly on COVID-19. They're reminiscent, actually, of President Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression and World War II. I'm hoping they'll be informative, comfortable, and fill a niche not otherwise addressed by materials otherwise available. Today, our chats again addresses the question of when and how should child and adolescent psychiatrists return physically to work and start seeing children and families during this pandemic. On my last chats, I spoke to Dr. Celso Arango, who was chief of child psychiatry and head of a large hospital in Madrid, Spain. Spain is a little ahead of us in the pandemic, and I thought he would be in a good position to share insights with us. However, we're opening up in the United States, and I thought it would be useful to speak to one of our preeminent child and adolescent psychiatrists. And so I'm happy to say today we have with us Dr. Tammy Benton. Tammy Benton is the chief of child and adolescent psychiatry at a very large children's hospital in Philadelphia, called the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She is also the Frederick Allen Professor of Psychiatry at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and chief of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry there. She's got so many things, I actually had to bullet them so I wouldn't get lost in my notes. She's also president-elect of the American Association of Directors of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Interested in youth suicidal behavior, she was recently awarded the Shelley Leaphart Williams Community Outreach Award by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the Humanitarian Award by the Society of Biological Psychiatry. Her work increasingly focuses on the development of the next generation of leaders in pediatric health care and mental health care, and developing partnerships between communities and academic centers to expand access to evidence-based care. At ACAP, Tammy has done a ton of things, and most recently she's been on my task force, and I've appointed her to oversee the Diversity and Culture Action Plan on mental health and equity among children of color during the era of COVID-19. I'm also pleased to say that she's this year's Virginia Q. Anthony's Women Leadership Award winner. So Tammy, thank you for taking time out of leading all of that stuff to spend time with us. So we were talking the other day, this is what got me going on this, and Dr. Benton was telling me all of the things she's been doing at CHOP, which is the acronym for their hospital at CHOP, to get the services back on their feet again. So where are you now with that, Dr. Benton?
So, you know, thank you, Gay, for that really gracious introduction. You know, the Academy has always been such a support for me during my career. But in addition to that, it's actually where I get most information that helps me run my department, you know, from my colleagues in child psychiatry. And so, you know, as you know, Gay, the return to work has been really challenging. This whole COVID-19 experience has really challenged, you know, our medical providers, and our patients and families. And, you know, we shut down just like everybody else during COVID. And in collaboration with a lot of the other child psychiatrists nationally, you know, we got together to figure out how we were going to get through COVID-19. So almost everybody immediately and masterfully converted to telepsychiatry, which was actually pretty remarkable. And I think when we're eventually beyond this pandemic and we think about what we accomplished in such a short period of time, it will be very surprising to us that we were able to accomplish that. And then now as we enter this other phase of ramp up, it's a whole different way of thinking about what the future is going to look like for us. And, you know, and how we're going to practice and what we're anticipating is another surge that's coming up. and, you know, and how we're going to get our clinicians through that, because it's really been very trying for the physicians in addition to our families. So what I can tell you about CHOP is, you know, we, like many other children's hospitals, have quite a few beds. We are over 500 beds, which makes us one of the larger children's hospitals. We have 55 ICU beds, which is a fairly large ICU. During the pandemic, we actually did not see a lot of COVID cases. So we did not have a lot of COVID positive kids. In our adult counterpart, in our Penn Hill system, that's where most of the treatment for COVID-19 infections occurred. And there was a significant shift in how beds were allocated. One of the pavilions was transformed into an ICU. Young adults and older adults were shifted back and forth between the adult hospitals, you know, Jefferson, Pennsylvania Hospital, Presbyterian, to accommodate those patients. And we eventually made some conversions at CHOP to expand care for young adults, older adolescents, so individuals between 18 and 24, who were not affected by COVID, but had other conditions. So one of the things that we talk about less that occurred during COVID is we prioritized those patients in the most serious conditions, which tended to be our COVID positive patients. But many of the other patients who needed routine care for chronic conditions did not receive that care. So we actually expanded our continuum to accommodate some of those patients. The number of children in the hospital who were COVID positive was actually quite low. And, you know, in order to assure safety for our staff and for the limited number of kids who were COVID positive, we established, like many other hospitals, special areas of the hospital with adequate ventilation and PPE to safely manage that population. And then we developed pretty rapid testing so we could test our own staff every 4 hours who had actually been exposed. And so, you know, we really focused on making sure that the staff, the nurses, the physicians, and all the people providing care were protected and safe at work.
So you picked up the slack for the other condition. I mean, people were still sick with other stuff. It isn't like it went away. And so it sounds like a lot of what you were able to do was absorb the care for those kinds of conditions. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, so now we're at the part where we're trying to get back to, I don't know what normal is, but anyway, something other than this. Outpatient departments are regearing and getting back to work. What are you doing there? Because I think that probably most reflects what people have to do in their day-to-day life. How are you running those specialty clinics? How are you running any consultation liaison things that you're doing? What have you learned that you can pass along to our members?
Yeah, so what's happening right now, you know, we talk about the inpatient hospital setting with consultations separate from our outpatient general practice and subspecialty care. You know, on the inpatient side, we started a phased ramp up. Actually, on both sides, we started a phased ramp up. Phase one was just bringing a small number of providers back on site. The second phase, we hope to get to at least 50% of capacity. And in the third phase of that ramp up, we wanted to get back to as close as possible to full capacity. And right now, we're in phase two of our ramp up. On the inpatient hospital side, it's different and a little more challenging because the rate of bringing people back on site for consultations very much relies on the ramp up for the medical clinicians. And so as the medical providers started to expand care and access, it required a larger number of our clinicians to come back to the hospital. We happen to have a fairly large inpatient service. So the inpatient service consists of about 50 psychologists and a team of about 11 psychiatrists. And it was very challenging to reintegrate a lot of those clinicians back into the healthcare setting. That was true for the pediatric services and for psychiatry. And a lot of that really had to do with the fact that school was out. People had been home taking care of their children. They didn't have other arrangements because daycare and schools were not open. And then there was a tremendous amount of fear about returning to work. And the way we the way that we closed services back in March really created a situation where most of the clinicians had actually not been on site since we closed and converted to telehealth. And so for those who had spent time in the hospital, even if it was episodic, if they were on call or if they were rotating shifts, it was much easier to come back to work than those who had not been on site at all.
And so that was cold turkey then for the people who'd been out and now they're coming back.
Yeah, and it really required a lot of work, and it still requires a lot of ongoing work to reassure people that, one, it's safe to return to work, that they're not coming to work exposing themselves or their family members to risk. And then in addition to that, we're looking at how can we alter schedules to be able to accommodate the needs of, you know, our clinicians. And so one of the things that we've been working on is trying to make work as predictable as possible, so that in a time of tremendous uncertainty, when nobody really knows what's going to happen, we wanted to create at least one situation where folks did know what was going to happen, and that we would be able to create an environment where there was some control over your schedule. And so we've started to think about how can we offer flexible scheduling. So for the inpatient consultation services, Are people willing to work evening hours, late afternoons? Are they willing to work on weekends when they normally wouldn't, if that accommodates their schedule more? Are folks willing to have longer days, fewer days of the week? How do we support people in their work from home? We anticipated that there would be most likely return to work. I anticipate will always be a combination of in-person and telehealth. But with the rapidly changing environment around telehealth, we're not sure what the reimbursement's gonna look like. But in our future, we're predicting that people can have a combination of both. And that allows a little more flexibility scheduling. So the phased ramp up for our inpatient teams has to coincide with the phased ramp up for the medical teams. And that's introduced another element of challenge around scheduling. But the hardest part has been getting the clinicians to come back to work. In our hospital, you know, in order to reassure people that they're coming back to a safe environment, you know, all of the chairs and physician leaders agreed to provide a weekly forum where we bring experts together to talk about the risk of COVID, progress with COVID, where are we with vaccines. We do that once a week for the entire medical staff. And that's
available virtually?
It's available virtually for everyone. So since most people, we're still in small group gatherings, very small group gatherings, we make these virtual faculty meetings where they're recorded, and so people can watch them at their leisure. And during those meetings, there's a tremendous amount of discussion, questions from the people who are actually doing the work. Around, you know, what can we anticipate about immunizations? How do we protect ourselves? You know, what are the latest advances in utilization of PPE? And that's actually been somewhat reassuring, but not entirely reassuring. You know, in our outpatient clinics, one of the things that we've struggled with is accurate and adequate social distancing. So how, in the context of our space constraints, are we able to maintain masking and 6 feet of social distancing, which quite honestly is very challenging. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've set up these, you know, diagrams of with arrows on the floor, like in the supermarket, of how patient flow happens. And in our first week, we found out it didn't work. It just didn't work because you didn't anticipate things like maybe the nurses were walking in a different direction, or maybe a kid went to the bathroom and they didn't follow the arrows. And so we have started a series of simulations where we're actually practicing, you know, what does it look like to move people through the clinic? And I'm not at all sure that we're gonna be able to meet our ramp up goals with our current space configuration. So we're still working on that.
It sounds like a great model for what the schools, God bless them, are going through. I was laughing because I was at the supermarket yesterday morning. I'm old enough to do the early morning hours, and they've put all those arrows in, and the arrow was coming down an arrow, you know, an aisle that I usually go up. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't want to go in this direction. I now have to go all the way around just to go in that direction. So I can imagine that it would be difficult. But so that's really interesting about the having the forum where people can talk about their concerns and get information, updates, and so forth. Do they get reassurance from each other? Because it seems to me that the people who've come back and are doing okay ought to be able to provide some degree of support for the people who are feeling anxious. Or is the fact that people can't really associate with each other, is that one of the things that's standing in the way of providing more sort of group support than you might otherwise want?
So Gay, that's a really excellent question. We actually are doing quite a lot of group support. You know, some lessons learned for us is that the communication, consistent communication through all of this is key. And so each one of the programs has their own weekly town halls, but they also have like virtual happy hours and other things that others are doing across the United States to be able to share experiences, but also to be able to share some fun time to get to know each other's families, because, you know, that's maintaining their mental health has been a major challenge. And I was going to talk a little bit about what we've had to do to address some of those concerns, but definitely not being able to see each other makes a huge difference. And I think now that we're coming back on site, people are a little more relieved because they are seeing folks. But there's still a significant amount of anxiety around, you know, COVID-19 and, you know, what are the risks to being at work? And, you know, so there's a lot of group support. I think we went a little bit overboard with messaging to folks. So they were getting 50,000 emails from me and then 50,000 emails from their program, then 50,000 emails from the institution. And it really was alert fatigue. And so we had to find some ways to digest the information that people really needed to be able to do their jobs and to deliver that in a way that was acceptable. So we started a weekly newsletter, which we'd never done before. And, you know, we had to find ways to communicate what everybody needed to know to be able to do their jobs. And so that has actually been very helpful. And then, of course, there's the patients. The patients didn't want to come back either. They, you know, got accustomed to telehealth. They became accustomed to being at home and being able to do video visits and not worry about safety. So it really was a requirement that the clinicians felt comfortable coming back to work in order to convince the patients to come back into the clinic.
Where telehealth is a problem for me, and that is I see complicated kids who you really need to have a situation where you have some control over what happens with the child, and having a hyperactive kid who doesn't want to sit in front of the camera is kind of is difficult, or having a recalcitrant teenager who won't cooperate. I wouldn't have a problem in my office, but I do have a problem online. So those people have to come back. But why do the other ones have to come back? Is it a payment thing, or is there some other reason that you want them back in the clinic?
So many of the patients who have to come back, you know, were kids with young people with mood disorders, or young people had intermittent suicidality who are in our mood programs. And so because you've not seen them in real life for some time, it's really important to be able to assess their level of suicidality. One of the things that we've been observing is that for a lot of our depressed adolescents and our anxious adolescents, the clinicians are reporting much more suicidal thinking for that population of kids. And, you know, one of the major drivers for patient admissions to the hospitals, the emergency departments. And the emergency departments have just had much lower volume. So it to maintain safety, families aren't coming into emergency departments. So you're kind of struggling to balance, you know, managing kids who have some concerning symptoms without access to the emergency department in the way that you would expect. And so it's really about kids who haven't been seen through COVID, who you were able to safely maintain for some time. But it's like all of the other medical specialties. There were kids you just didn't see because you didn't really need to during COVID, but eventually they need to be seen because they haven't been seen for a while. And so those are some of the folks who have to come back to the clinics.
So speaking of the suicidal kids, I know that's one of your areas of interest. Are you aware of any virtual suicidal approaches, or has anybody come up with anything to help that particular population of kids?
So, I mean, there's a really nice pathway that I discovered on the ACAP website for making assessments of suicidal youth. And, you know, essentially, there's not really a standard for how you assess those kids. What we've been trying to do is we've been trying to use the Columbia. Because we implement the Columbias throughout our whole practice, we continue to implement them electronically. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, we're actually starting to look at what the differences in the Columbia ratings have been for our teenagers pre-COVID and post-COVID, so we can get a sense of whether the Columbia is a good way to gauge how they're doing. But essentially what's been happening is we've started to bring them in, mm-hmm. that they really need to be seen. If in fact they were not previously endorsing suicidal ideation, we've brought them in for in-person live visits.
And then how do you manage them after that? I mean, here they are, they're feeling shakier, they don't have the, you know, social supports they used to have, et cetera. What do you do then? What's plan B?
Yeah. So, you know, some of us have just continued to bring them on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. I really think for our kids, just like our staff, I think Jim Hudziak's recommendations on focusing on building resilience. And so the partnerships with the parents have to be stronger, and we have to find ways to support their healthy functioning. So, you know, trying to get the kids to get more engaged in exercise, helping them expand their social networks. We're actually still doing group supports virtually. So for those kids who are particularly isolated, we continue to use group support interventions. And then we've been doing more family interventions with the kids that we think are at risk, and we've been bringing them in. But I think the focus on prevention and utilizing resources that can help your mental health that don't necessarily require seeing a professional are really important during COVID-19. And we're finding that for our clinicians as well, Gay. So, you know, on the issue of getting the clinicians to come back to work and feel more comfortable in their work environment, we really had to develop a whole series of mental health supports for the physicians.
I'm going to pull the rug out from under you with this question because I didn't put it on my list, I don't think. But we're going into a period now where people are wanting kids to go back to school. And it seems to me that what we've learned from, or what we're learning from how to manage COVID with our healthcare workers, maybe there's some things that we can take into the school environment. So what would you say in terms of helping? Okay, fine, masks, social distancing. We know that it isn't doing it. It's how to do that that's the problem. But the mental health part, that's our wheelhouse, I guess, is what they say. How are we going to help the teachers? Because if the teachers ain't happy, kids aren't going to be happy. How would you say we should help them?
So I think the same approach, basically. The approach we have taken to preparing our healthcare professionals, which really is about education about safety practices, how to keep yourself safe, a good understanding as much as possible of how the virus works based on what we know. So the basic safety education is a major factor in preparing people to receive the rest of the information they need to receive to support kids. The other piece of it is helping folks manage their own anxiety. Okay? And that has been a major focus of what we've had to do for our clinicians. So we set up regular discussions a couple of times weekly. The clinicians actually can call in. We have a group of psychologists and psychiatrists who respond to questions that folks may have about COVID, about uncertainty, about their anxiety, about things that are coming up. And we create regular forums for folks to have those discussions. Another thing that we've been doing for managers, and this is something that we're actually thinking about doing with the schools as well, is developing sort of a training for managers and leaders and teachers to become coaches in their own environment. So we know that most of the folks who come back to work, or most of the teachers who go back to school, will be fine. I mean, they're resilient. Their resilience will be supported, but there's a significant portion of folks who won't. And then how is it that we can help help identify the ones who are struggling and provide supports for them. So we've developed sort of a training model for teachers, for managers, for administrators, for clinical leaders, some basic skills for identifying when individuals are having more distress than is appropriate, or when people are in trouble, or when folks might need more intervention. And they're basic tools like utilizing mental health first aid or psychological first aid, active listening. But we're trying to prepare teams and leaders to be able to support their teams through the return to work. And that is the model that we're using to approach the teachers.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really good idea. When we were talking about setting up your clinics in a way where you would be able to have the kids come in and have their family seen, and it wouldn't be too cumbersome with all of the cleaning and the awkwardness that goes on with it. Did you figure out a way to do that? We were sort of teasing about having screens that were movable, and I don't know what people are doing in their physical clinics, but I wondered how you were solving that physical problem in your outpatient clinics.
So we've actually established some protocols for what each clinician should do after seeing every patient. Mm-hmm. The masking really continues to be a bit of a problem. When you're interviewing younger kids, particularly in the long interviews, you really can't hear them very well. They speak softly. That's problematic with the social distancing. You know, with the observation, we have a lot of observation rooms so that, you know, that you can amplify the volume. So if you're sitting in the other room, you can actually hear pretty well. But that doesn't work when you have to sit face to face with the young person. In our communication disorder center, they've actually found some masks that have a clearing around the mouthpiece so that you can actually see that person's lips as they're talking. But they've been in very short supply, so that, you know, that still remains a challenge. The clinicians, you know, have been trying to maintain the 6 feet, but I have to be honest with you, with the way many of the offices are set up, and I'm sure this is true across the United States, 6 foot social distancing is really going to be difficult to maintain. And so the masking and the hand washing becomes more of a priority. The clinicians wipe down all the toys with Oxivir wipes, and they clean the offices after every visit, just because you can't get housekeeping in that quickly. But, you know, we're still working through how to make the flow go a little more smoothly. But it's a daily challenge, and it changes on a daily basis. So I wish I could say, Gay, we've worked it out. We spend a lot of time huddling. We huddle every day, every morning, so that we can talk about what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve the throughput of patients in the clinics.
You know what we need, I think, as people in positions that you have, I don't know whether you're going to build this into your ADCAP president role, but it sounds to me like the leaders of different children's hospitals or just different programs in general could really benefit for the same kind of support groups that you're talking about with the leadership in your hospital. I mean, people learn and try different things. We need to be able to communicate that in real time rather than a publication.
You know what? I think that would be true, Gay. I mean, you know, it's this whole COVID thing, I believe it's really been very remarkable to me to watch leaders in child psychiatry really step up and develop very creative and innovative ways of managing all the aspects of this pandemic. So, you know, we talk often, we've had the town halls. You've held some town halls through ACAP, which has been really informative to our members. But I do believe that as we're looking at this next, you know, the surge that's coming, I wish I could say the next wave, but the last wave's not over. What we can anticipate is a surge in the fall. And we're trying to prepare for that. And, you know, there's some lessons learned. Sending everybody home may not be the solution. It makes it really hard for folks to come back. So we have to think about that differently. And we really have to be proactive in thinking about how we're going to support the mental health of our physicians through this next wave, because there hasn't been a lot of relief. So we started all this in March, and, you know, now we're approaching September with another anticipated surge. So it's not as if folks have had time to really recover from the last one. How are we going to support our physicians? how we're going to support our trainees. So one of the things we've been focusing on is preparing ourselves to support the mental health of the workforce. In addition to the ongoing support groups, like some other programs, we're setting up a 24-hour support line for physicians so that if they have questions or concerns at any point during the day, they can call and a clinician will answer the phone and be able to respond to their questions and concerns. We are also expanding that sort of train the trainer model so that the clinical leaders and the administrative leaders know how to prevent and identify challenges for our physicians. And then the other piece is we've actually adapted something from Penn. So Penn Medicine has established a platform called Cobalt. It's really, really phenomenal. This Penn Center for Innovation and the Department of Psychiatry have established a software platform that allows any person to access a menu of services from their phone. And so utilizing Cobalt, they can identify wellness resources, education resources, peer-to-peer consultation, group support, and or a clinician if they actually need more individual treatment. And we're modifying the Cobalt platform to be able to accommodate the child psychiatrist and the child psychiatry residents and fellows. And so we're really trying to prepare for the next wave by strengthening our staff to be able to address what comes up and support their resilience.
I think that's really insightful of you, and I'm not surprised given your leadership that you've thought along those lines. I think we've probably come to the end of this discussion. It's a really good place to end because I hear some optimism in there. I think we have learned a lot as we've gone along with this. And I think facing it honestly is one of the most important things that we can do so that we are able to continue to function. So I thank you very much, Dr. Benton. And I thank our audience for tuning in. And I think probably our next chats will go a little bit into more depth about how we can help schools. So thank you again. And
thank you, Gay.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAPS Screenside Chats.